All right, everybody, it is 1 p.m., so I am going to get us started with today's webinar. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I'd like to welcome everybody to today's training, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. My name is Devin Suchker. I'm your moderator today. I'm going to start with a few housekeeping rules while we are in Zoom, and then we will get started with the content. So this training is an introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide, Optimizing Injection Strategies and In-Situ Remediation Performance. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2019. We cannot cover all the information, tools, and resources available in this guidance, so please visit the website and take a look if you haven't already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you as you work on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. So, some housekeeping rules for today. I'm sure some of you are familiar with them, but I will go over them nonetheless for our new attendees. Today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes. As I mentioned before, we are recording this event to make it available on demand for those not able to join us live. Trainers will be in control of their slides as we move through today's training session. If you'd like to control your own slides, they are available for download on the initial training page that directed you here today. In Zoom, you have access to the Q&A window where you can ask any questions or report technical issues at any time. We will have two Q&A breaks during the training where we will answer questions out loud. If we have too many questions to get to during those two Q&A breaks, then our trainers will answer those questions via typing a message through our Q&A pod. There is an online feedback form available for completion to let us know how the training went today. By completing the feedback form, you will also be eligible to receive a certificate of completion to support any documentation of continuing education for today's course. At the end of the feedback form, you will be able to certify that you participated today by checking a box, and then a certificate will be issued to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to become a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide number five, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers that are joining us today. All of them have been active members of ITRC's in-situ remediation team over the years. Not only have they served as volunteer trainers, but they also dedicated many hours to developing this guidance document and training course. A special thank you to all of them for participating today. All of our trainers' information is here listed on the slide, and it is also available on the CLUIN training page that brought you to the webinar today. All of their bios and contact information is listed. So with that, I will pass it off to our first trainer, Chris McCandless from the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Devin. Appreciate it. And welcome to this training, this web-based webinar. You've got the last 10 years, ITRC has been, up with the times and generating these documents on the web. So there's the link to the document, and the web really allows us to really link and do all kinds of things that are so makes frees up being on 8.5 by 11 paper. Good. Thank you for bringing up the slide there, Devin. Oops, there we go. All right. So have you ever had a remedy not meet design expectations? Let's go ahead and give you a few minutes there. Basically, okay, let's pull it down now. Devin, let's see what our response is. 80 and 20. All right, good deal. Well, for the 80%, you're in the right spot if you said yes to the poll question. But if you're the 20% that said no, there are a handful of us who contributed to this guidance that would like to know your secret. As our first slide implies, this webinar is aimed at your site involving injection of amendments at the correct dosages for the in-situ remediation of contaminant mass and how to optimize any phase of that process. Although the subject of in-situ remediation is far from new, everyone, even the ones who said no to the poll question, have encountered challenges when it comes to in-situ remediation. The problem we are facing is failing to achieve the expected objectives or the performances of in-situ injection remedies and encountering unknown variables that impact effectiveness. Our team did a survey of state regulators across the U.S. for remediation proposals that they received, and about 40% of them deemed the first submittal as incomplete. Why? Well, it hinged around an incomplete conceptual site model, which in turn led, for example, to inadequate amendment placement or choosing the wrong delivery for the site geology. What is optimization? Optimization is the effort at any cleanup phase to identify and implement actions that improve effectiveness and cost efficiency from that phase. This statement was produced from ITRC's 2016 geospatial analysis for optimization. For in-situ remediation, we are emphasizing the management of risks and uncertainties through sound science and engineering during different stages of in-situ remedy planning and implementation. This webinar and the document intend to promote the best practices for the benefits of all, that being the regulatory agencies like mine, responsible parties, consultants like you all, and the public. I want you to think of this document and its tables and fact sheets as an optimization toolbox. On the left is your first introduction to the layout of this guidance document. And on the right are those tools we're going to use to optimize the remedial process. We want to make it clear that we wrote this document for remediation managers, responsible parties, and regulators. We did not write this document as a remediation 101. So you need to be familiar with the principles of in-situ remediation and preparation of a CSM. We also wrote this for state regulators to identify potential shortcomings in remediation plans and to ask specific questions of the consultants and responsible parties. So, perhaps you've written a good CSM, you feel pretty confident about your remedy selection, but you want to make sure that there are no data gaps or that your amendments will work with the selected delivery method. So, what are some more of these challenges? Are you having higher concentrations after injections compared to baseline? Or is there no indication of a change after an amendment injection? Do you have insufficient amendment distribution and contact at your site? Or is your amendment daylighting? Or, oh my gosh, are you using the vendor's dosing default values instead of data from your CSM? With these challenges in mind, let's head to Table 1.1 in Appendix B of the guidance. This slide is the snapshot of the commonly encountered issues associated with remedial design characterization. This is one of three sections in this table, the other two being commonly encountered issues with amendment dose and delivery, and commonly encountered issues with field implementation. As you identify your lithology and contaminant, being the two left columns, you read the common challenges, lessons learned, and get answers via the fourth column, which contains links to the content within the text, links to view a particular delivery or amendment fact sheet, and links to other documents, including applicable ITRC guidance as shown here. I want you to think of this table as your customized table of contents, tailored to your particular site conditions or to the challenges you're facing. Okay, here are today's learning objectives. We have just been identifying the challenges. Now, the key phrase or watchword for today in that second bullet is iterative optimization. Let me show you how better the rest of the day is going to go for you, the next next 2 hours or so. I've introduced the optimization process. Now, Rich DeRozier is going to cover remedial design characterization. Suzanne will cover amendment dose and delivery design. And then Dave Becker is going to pick up on implementation monitoring and interpretation. Then I will circle back and cover regulatory and stakeholder considerations. This flowchart is likely familiar to most of you because it's the CERCLA process of remediating sites and taking them to closure, which is similar to the RCRA process for petroleum impacted sites. As we developed this guidance document, we realized that the linear approach to the left gave us no flexibility. And so our key graphic was born on the right side of your slide. By now, you've gotten a good hint of the three main elements of our document: the remedial design characterization in the red hexagon, the amendment dose and delivery design wheel, and the implementation monitoring and interpretation in the blue hexagon. Can you see the difference simply in the arrows connecting both diagrams, left and right? We discovered that optimization was the outcome of better characterizing our subsurface conditions, improving the CSM, performing bench tests and pilot studies, making mistakes, and then going back to an earlier step, i.e., the double-headed arrows. We realized the most flexible approach had to be iterative. We are not replacing the RCRA chart to the left, we are augmenting it by placing our key graphic basically between remedial design, remedial action, and those second, third, and the second from the bottom areas of that flow chart. Guess what? The iterative approach is nothing new. This slide shows you where our three optimization steps fit into the flow chart for the remediation of DNAPL. In ITRC's 2011 Integrated DNAPL Site Strategy Guidance Document. So, as I've been drilling into you now, as you're hearing me saying, the true nature of in-situ remediation is iterative. As Suzanne and Dave will demonstrate during the bench test and pilot test phases of design, the green wheel design section, and the full-scale application, or the blue hexagon, the process of implementing, monitoring, and optimization of in-situ takes place. Do you see the opportunities for optimization, i.e. the return arrows or feedback loops, take you back to the miniature design wheels if, let's say, an amendment or delivery method doesn't work? This iterative approach lets the CSM become adaptable to new technologies and new contaminants, which we know we have coming up. All right, we're now going to get into our first hexagon, which is remedial design characterization with Rich DeRozier of GZA Geoenvironmental. Take it away, Rich.
Thank you, Chris, and good day, everybody. I was going to say good morning or good afternoon, but depending on where you are. What I'd like to talk about, as Chris was mentioning, in terms of this roadmap, the remedial design characterization, why is this so important? Before you start designing your amendment, your dosing, your monitoring, and even talking with regulators. In other words, you really need to know what data that you have in order to design. Because as Chris pointed out at the onset, 80% said that they've had some issues with an initial injection, and a lot of those issues start right here in the remedial design aspects. Just getting my clicker to work. So we keyed a new word here, or a new acronym, RDC, Remedial Design Characterization. So what is this? It is really the question a lot of people have asked. It's really the collection of additional data above and beyond the general characterization necessary to develop a sufficient detailed conceptual site model. It really is the basis to develop a successful in-situ remedy. You may say, well, I've already have a lot of site characterization data. I've done my due diligence. I went out and did a phase two. I went out and did further the nature and extent with a phase three. And we'll all agree with you that you did your due diligence in order to find the nature and extent of a contaminant plume. However, we're drilling down in the area that we're going to be injecting material into or amendments, and we really need more detail there. So that's really where the remedial design characterization comes in. The issue comes is why do you want to do it? And as I indicated just a second ago, is you've done a lot of the hard work. You've identified where the plume is. But when it comes to developing an in-situ remedy, they tend to fail or produce less than optimum outcomes. And it's usually due to the lack of detailed data with the conceptual site model in the areas that you're looking to add the amendments. So that's a little different. You've got the aerial extent, and now we're really looking at the details as to where we're going to inject those amendments. So really the success of the in-situ remedy is really related to the better understanding of the site and its subsurface conditions in the area of the remedy that you're proposing. So I've got a couple of examples here where in this particular figure, we're looking at, gray, which are our low permeable soils, the light green are the moderate, and the dark green are the high permeable materials. So we have an alluvium formation. We've got seven borings spread out about 140 feet. We're looking at a 3,500-foot alignment across this seven borings, and the soil has been logged every 5 feet. So a lot of people, this was the state of the art at one point in time. So here we can start seeing some more complexity starting to come in. The colors are still the same, but now we have 40 borings across that same 3,500 linear foot alignment. The soils are still logged at every 5 feet within the vadozone zone and logged continuously below the water table. So we've got more data below the water table to understand the nature of the contaminant migration. And now you can start seeing there's a whole lot more increased complexity as we gather more data. We look at the next slide. We now start seeing an entirely different conceptual site model than what we had two slides earlier. Here we have 60 borings over the same 3,500 foot linear alignment. All the soils are logged continuously. And you can see the evolving of this cross section. You start seeing there's a lot more gray or low permeable materials. We have the higher permeable materials sort of in lenses. And now you want to be able to inject amendments. You also see that the water table has some different elevations, which are the blues, some perched, maybe a more permanent groundwater elevation. So if you're going in and you're going to inject an amendment, you now have to try to say, well, where am I going to inject that amendment? I don't want to be injecting it in the low permeable material. I want to be injecting it into the higher permeable material where I'm going to be much more successful. So what do we need to know in order to design the remediation based upon site characterization? We really need to understand the geology, that is, the properties that define the flow regime, those low and high permeable units, the hydrogeology, How does that influence groundwater flow? And more importantly, the transport going from point A to point B? And what are the geochemistry? Because the geochemistry is going to be very important in terms of adding your amendments. So what are your electron acceptors? What are those competitors? Are you going to have metals that might mobilize? Those are the type of geochemical data that you really need to understand. So again, a higher level of information over and above a phase two or a phase three. And of course, microbiology is very important to determine degradation potential. So in the document itself, we sort of went through and developed this graphic as to why do it. So as a consultant, I have to go to my client and I'm going to tell him, I want to spend a whole lot more money upfront on characterization before I start any remediation. That may be a hard sell, but we created this graphic to show why the importance of RDC before you begin the remedy is very important, critical, and cost-effective. So what we're looking at is the value of the investigation, the VOI. That's this figure, is why do you want to spend more money? So we have two lines. We have the red line that you can see that goes out further in time on the x-axis, and costs are increased on the y-axis. So again, you didn't have RDC, so you just went out with what you had. Your remedy was ineffective, and it took longer. And the blue line shows you that in your phase ones, two, and threes, they're all the same cost. You're adding additional cost in the center column with your RDC. And in the third column on your remediation, where the blue point, if you notice, is lower and more towards the left. In other words, it's less expensive and it took less time to achieve the remedy. So how do we get there? So here's an example of a value of the investigation. So here's a 20-acre site that's in the Central Valley of California. Mostly VOCs impacts to both soil and groundwater. Floodplain deposits in the target treatment zone is the sand lens several feet thick, approximately 15 feet below grade. The initial remedy, we had a very tight redevelopment timeframe. We were looking to use enhanced in situ bioremediation using sodium lactate. Pretty straightforward remedy for VOCs. So the good news is that cross-section you saw was very well characterized. The geology was well understood. The injections were properly informed and performed within the sand interval. So in other words, we got to the amendment where we wanted it to, and we knew where the amendment needed to go. What were the bad news? Well, the hydraulic conductivity wasn't fully evaluated. There wasn't an injection test. There were no geochemical parameters used to assess the viability. No treatability tests were done. The choice of the substrate and dosing. If you remember, Chris, you used a couple words earlier. Well, we based it upon the vendor, or we based it upon a similar site. So that's how we went out and proceeded with this site. The microbial studies were not performed, and upgrading sources were not assessed. So we understood where we needed to go, but we didn't have all the tools to get there. So what was the outcome? And if you can pull up the poll question while I go through this. So the outcome was there were no reductions in the groundwater contamination concentrations, and the site redevelopment was delayed. So you can see on that previous slide, getting there sooner would have been more important on this particular case. So if the site had the RDC, we would have better defined the source, better defined the plume. We would have had better aquifer testing to estimate the hydraulic conductivity and the radius of influence. We would have understood the microbial testing, treatability studies to understand what various substrates would do and what the dosing would be, and removaling of the upgradient sources. So the poll you've been reading says, have you ever had to perform in situ reworks because of poor initial site characterization? Devin, could you bring up those results, please? And similar to what Chris had earlier, 75-25, the answer is pretty much yes. You had to restart again, or you had to go back out and redo things. So if we could close that poll. So here's sort of the outcome of that case study. So we have a couple of different columns. We have a column for the item that we're going out to do, the cost and the years. So you can see the initial site characterization at 150,000. They're both the same, whether you're doing no RDC or with RDC. That's your initial upfront characterization. The upfront RDC in this thing here is a hypothetical $160,000. The implementation of the remedy, $300,000 initially. And obviously, we didn't do anything because we didn't have any RDC. The monitoring to find out that it wasn't very successful at 80,000. And then you have the rework. You had the RDC as part of the rework for 160,000. And again, if you look at that, you can start seeing that 160,000 and this 160,000 are the same. The implementation of the remedy, remember, we had to do it again on the first time, so that's still 200,000. And with the RDC, we did it right this time, so that's the same 200,000. The monitoring still becomes the 70,000. And then what we really start getting is what happened as a result of doing the RDC. There was a net savings that could have been had of $380,000 if we just went with the RDC upfront. And more importantly, the remedy went from 8 years to 5 years. So there was a net savings of 3 years. And again, on any remedial project, costs are really critical, but sometimes more importantly, getting the job done sooner is equally as important. So in the ITRC document, there's a table, and I don't want you to read this table because it's very busy and we'll get into more details. But this is a very interactive document, so you can go in and click a variety of different things. But the table does tell you what you need to know and why you would need to have it. So there's some physical properties, some flow properties, some aqueous geochemical, and like I said, I'll get into these in more detail. Microbial and degradation potential. So you can sort of see the common themes earlier in terms of our discussion are still carried forward here in these tables. So let's look at the table in a little bit more detail in terms of the headers. What we wanted to look at was, are you going in to do a screening, a design, or performance monitoring? Each of those have different levels of information that you need. And in your in situ approach, are we really looking at biotic or abiotic degradation? That's also very important because that is going to change the amendment that Suzanne will be talking about. And then on the legend, you can see the color code, more or less applicable, or the different colors for low, medium, and high. So drilling into these a little deeper now that you can see them more easily, what we have is the properties here for physical properties. So you can see that we have the provenance in mineralogy. So in terms of the screening and remedy, it's either high, medium, or low. So not so critical in terms of performance monitoring, but in terms of screening and understanding, very important. But more importantly, if you hover over the provenance in mineralogy, then what you're going to get is a pop-up box. And it's going to give you a description of that information and why it might be important and what are the factors that are go into those provenances in mineralogy. You also see the same thing if you look at stratigraphy. Again, each of these has a definition. So there's a lookup table that's within the document. And as you hover over it, you'll get the definitions and understand more importantly why you want to do these things. So flow properties, again, same thing, heterogeneity. Why do we want to understand that when we're looking at contaminant migration within media? We can see that the one of the case studies, we had a fairly linear depositional event. So again, more more uniform soil conditions along that stratigraphic unit. Where the other one we saw that we had more silts, clays, and sands. So a lot more heterogeneity there. So that's going to really dictate how we move forward with the injection and dosing. Same thing holds true with anisotropy. All of these have pop-up menus for you so that you can look at them and understand why you want to gather more information. And again, looking to the right, the color code, some of these are considered much higher in terms of the relationship of information that you need, where performance monitoring, we're going to put those wells in, and anisotropy here is probably not as critical to understand for a monitoring well, but for screening and design purposes, they are. So again, we get into the geochemistry. So we listed a whole lot of different parameters. And a lot of these are very important in terms of selecting your amendment and looking at, are there going to be interactions? So here we've highlighted sulfate. So if we look at, sulfate, there's some pros and cons of having sulfate that is naturally present within the groundwater. And it can be, pros and cons. And one of the poll questions we have here related to sulfate, if we could bring it up, how many people have actually experienced sulfate as being beneficial or an inhibitor to an in situ implementation? And I would argue in certain cases, having sulfate may get you a quicker remedy, whereas in other cases, depending on the amendment you're putting, maybe an inhibitor. So if we can bring up the poll to see what people think. Close to 50-50, but we see probably a little bit more as an inhibitor than a benefit. And so I think from that standpoint, I would agree with you that, sulfate can be a burden as you're trying to move forward with various amendments. So again, we have another poll question that we'll get to. So I'll read this and then go through this discussion. So in your experience, can chloride concentrations be effectively used as a line of evidence of reductive dechlorination? And we can sort of see here that, is this something that if we're going after a chlorinated solvents or other areas for remediation, is this something in your experience do you see as being an effective line of evidence? So if we could have the answer to that poll question. And I would agree with this one as well. Chloride can be a really good and effective use for a line of evidence looking at dechlorination. So you can start seeing how we can start using these interactive tables to understand, why baseline conditions need to be understood, and then looking at after the amendment, what is the post concentrations? So those can be used from a regulatory standpoint to demonstrate the effectiveness of the remedy. And here we've got microbial and degradation potentials. Again, you can start seeing, dissolved hydrocarbon gases. And I've done a number of injections where we've got down to methanogenesis and we've got methane being generated. And we can measure that in terms of the degradation that may be going on. And therefore, these are other indicators that we can use to show lines of evidence that the remedy that we've proposed and we've injected in the ground is actually being effective, that perhaps we're seeing sulfate reduction and then we're getting into methanogenesis. And as a result, we can monitor methane as part of the hydrocarbon gases. So with that, I'm going to turn this back over to Devin because this is our first question and answer.
All right. Thank you so much, Rich, and our other trainers for the first portion of our training here today. As Rich mentioned, this is our first Q&A, so if anybody has any questions, please enter those into the Q&A pod and our trainers will get to them. We will have one more opportunity for Q&A at the end of our modules again. So, two opportunities for questions here today. As a quick reminder, just while we wait for some questions, if you're interested in a feedback form for today's training, they are available by completing, excuse me, if you're interested in certificates of completion, they are available by completing the feedback form at the end of the training today. That feedback form can be found on the Clue-In training page that brought you to the webinar today. So with that, I will just pause here for a moment and see if we have any questions. And if not, we can move on to our next portion of the presentation and save time at the end for more questions. Okay, we have a few coming in for our trainers. So our first question, what are the best ways to learn about amendments and the science behind them?
I guess I'll start with that. Maybe Suzanne, you want to jump in as well. But to learn about different amendments, obviously ITRC has some excellent documents in terms of a variety of information that's out there. Also going to a number of conferences to be able to learn what other people are using for a variety of contaminants. And there's a sea of webinars that are out there from an educational standpoint. So I think you have to look at the in situ conditions that you have, the geochemistry, and look at your radius of influence when you're doing your injections. Those studies are very important. And then you can look at doing bench scale studies to figure out which amendment might be better than the other.
All right, thank you, Rich. Our next question, what would be a good indicator of hydrocarbon decontamination in groundwater?
I don't know if you want me to try. I can try to answer that. I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of the time, I mean, it's whatever the degradation products are of the hydrocarbons that you're looking for. Obviously, decreases in concentration are usually a pretty good indicator as well. So I think it would partly depend also on what method you're using for your remedy.
All right. Thank you, Suzanne. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, all good.
All right, our next question. Can you provide an overview of byproducts of in situ bioremediation, such as high arsenic concentrations for chlorinated solvents treatment?
Yeah, so some of that is actually going to be touched on in the next section. So maybe I'll wait to if that question you isn't fully answered in section three, where during my presentation, maybe we can raise that one again if you still have questions.
Thank you. Next question. How can you target the amendment in the vertical section of a well? Is it on a targeted completion or jetting slash swabbing injection?
Yeah, I'll start with this one. That's a great question, and it also goes back into the characterization. So I'll start with an example and then come back in and try to give a better answer in terms of the vertical section. I had a site where we were proposing to inject into a formation where we had basically a non-detect below a value of 9 ppm of TCE. And we had a clay layer at the boundary, and 5 feet below that clay was the non-detect. And we thought everything was fine. In this particular case, we had a great client who asked, could we get a little extra data? So we used a lot of high-resolution site characterization using MIP profiling and a variety of other techniques, including grab samples. And what we found is that 9 that non-detect 5 feet below the clay boundary was a false aspect, because directly above that was an 8 ppm directly below the clay unit. And the clay unit was a stringer, not necessarily a boundary condition. But in this particular case, the non-detect had a vertical upward flow that we didn't understand initially. And so if we had injected the material, we would have missed the 8 ppm of TCE directly below that clay unit, and our monitoring wells would have then said we would have had a problem. How we injected in that particular case was not in a, we could have injected in wells, which we have done, but on something like that, again, if you understand your geology and you can contour the bottom of where the contaminant is and where the top of the contaminant is, then you can go back in with direct injections, and you can inject either from the top to the bottom or the bottom to the top, depending on how the formation is and what is your effective radius of influence. So I think you can look at it in terms of understanding your radius of influence through direct injections, which you can do on a 1 foot screen using a geoprobe. Or if you want to put it in a monitoring well, again, you could screen that whole area. But again, understanding the hydraulic conductivity, you may end up having preferential pathways where there's a higher K and a lower K. Your amendment is probably going to go into the higher K area. So if you inject in the well and you think you're getting a percentage in the lower K, you're probably not going to get there. So perhaps in that case, you want to have shorter screen lengths. And therefore, you have multiple screens, or going in with direct injection using geoprobe with short injection screens.
I'll just build on that. I agree with everything that Rich just said. I think the other thing to consider too is depending on what your remedy is and how you're how long you think your amendment will last and how many times you're going to need to reinject it. That's another thing to consider when you're trying to decide between wells and direct push injection. If you think you're going to be doing multiple injections over the same depth intervals over time, then sometimes wells are your more cost-effective approach. But what they don't allow is any changes in your injection locations. So direct push injection, even though you may need to mobilize a rig out repeatedly to do, multiple injections over time, it allows you to change the depth intervals and the locations of those points every time to target whatever remaining mass there might be, or if you're getting additional information in your monitoring that indicates that you've got some hotspots that maybe you didn't aren't getting as effectively treated, you can then you have a bit more flexibility that way.
All right, thank you, trainers. Our next question is it typical to inject into monitoring wells?
Yeah, I think Suzanne put it very well. Monitoring wells have their limitation as they're not movable. On the other hand, as she indicated, reinjection gives you the opportunity to going back to the same location. I've done both. I think my preference is to be able to move from point to point and going in with direct push. But I've also done permanent wells with extraction wells to do an injection and extraction and recirculation at the same time in areas of low K values. In other words, the direct injection wasn't effective. A monitoring well would not be effective because of the silty low K units, and we needed to develop what's typically referred to as a concentration gradient, so that we were flushing out the high K areas with the amendment, in this case here, an oxidant, and allowing the concentrations from the low Ks to migrate into the high Ks, and having a water flood move across there to be very effective, rather than going in with multiple additional injections. And it all depends on your geology, your hydrogeology, your lithology in terms of hydraulic conductivity. Sometimes you have to go with the flow in terms of it being able to be flexible, looking at your data. And again, the rationale as to why we have this section in here in terms of the greater detailed and site characterization is that the subsurface conditions are not homogeneous and isotropic. They vary significantly. Even slight variations in hydraulic conductivity are going to make a whole big difference in terms of how you're going to inject and the concentration of reductions based upon those amendments.
All right, thank you, trainers. So that concludes our first Q&A break. We will also have one at the end of our next modules as well. So with that, I will pass it over to Suzanne O'Hara from GeoSyntech for our next section.
All right. So I am going to be talking about the design, which is section three of our guidance document. So the design, this design wheel has shown up a few times so far in the training. And the design wheel is considering or your design, involves a consideration of your proposed amendment, your delivery method, and the dose of that amendment considered throughout your design, as well as your implementation and monitoring process. And any step in that sequence can be repeated as new information becomes available. So again, we're getting to that iterative nature and why this is shown as a wheel. So Chris had this graphic up earlier where we've got our design wheel, which is our, delivery dose amendment components. And your design can be, refined, what after you select your amendment and delivery strategy by applying various tests, things like bench testing or pilot testing. And all of those also apply that dose delivery and amendment design feedback. So that little delivery wheel, if you or sorry, design wheel, if you went into your if doing a bench test at a site, again, you're going to pick what amendment you're going to do a bench test on. You're going to figure out what dose you're going to do that and what delivery method you're going to use. You're going to implement your bench test, monitor it, and then you have an opportunity to optimize it. Do you want to go back up and change the dose of that amendment? Did that amendment not work well and you want to pick a different one and try again? So you get this optimization staircase, and at the end of your bench testing phase, you're ready to maybe move to a pilot test phase where, again, you're doing that same consideration of what are you going to test, what information are you collecting, and how can you optimize it. And it's really important that at all steps of any kind of design and site investigation work, everything you're learning feeds back into the subsequent test or into the next step of your design. So that's that iterative nature. So one of the first steps of your design is determining what your target treatment zone is going to be. That too is often iterative. You have to consider things like collateral effects, performance, costs. And as you're working through your design, that target treatment zone itself may be re have to be revised. And some of the things that you need to consider when you're defining that target treatment zone are things like cleanup objectives. Those objectives may be a reduction in source area mass, protection, sorry, of a particular receptor, meeting an interim remedial goal, achieving site closure, or some other site-specific objective. Another thing that you need to consider is the spatial and temporal relationship of your target treatment zone to other remedies. So if you're doing, say, in situ chemical oxidation, for a DNAPL source area at your site, but you're considering in situ chemical reduction to treat a plume area, downgrading of that, need to understand how those two target treatment zones are going to interact with each other. Another thing to consider is uncontrolled amendment discharge. So let's say you're going to be doing a remedy in an area where there's a potential for groundwater to discharge to surface water, then you really need to make sure you understand that potential for unintended discharge to surface water in your target treatment zone definition. And then, of course, the geology, hydrogeology, geochemistry of your site is another key thing that you're going to have to be taking into account as you define your target treatment zone. So there's various design support elements that can be used to help you with that design. The design elements are extensions of your conceptual site model and your remedial design characterization data. And as we've emphasized before, one of the main source of failure for amendment injection is a lack of an adequately detailed characterization of your target treatment zone or a reliance on an overly simplified conceptual site model. So some of the design elements that are talked about in the guidance document and that we'll touch on today are using modeling and analytical tools, lab tests like bench testing, and then field pilot tests. So in order to work through this section of the guidance document training, we've come up with a conceptual site model. So this is a site where we've got an industrial site. We've gone out and done the characterization, the remedial design characterization stage for this. We know we have a sands and silts with an underlying clay. We know we have had a solvent release in the past, and we've got source material both in the sands and silts as well as in that underlying clay. So we've done our remedial design characterization. And we're ready now to move into our remedial design for this site. With the contaminants we have and the groundwater chemistry we have and the hydrogeology, the flow rate, and whatnot, we're considering in situ chemical oxidation or bioremediation for this site. So one of the tools that are out there to help you with your design are these modeling and analytical tools. These can include parameter estimation, groundwater flow and transport models, or geochemical models and geochemical tools. These can range from simple spreadsheet calculation tools to complex 3D models. And some of the software to do these types of to use, sorry, these types of modeling and analytical tools are available in the public domain, and others are commercially available and require a license. So in the guidance document, we do list a number of the tools that are available in the public domain and how some of those might be used. So one of the other tools that we can use to help us with our design are laboratory treatability bench scale testing. So these are great tools. They should be done using site-specific materials, so groundwater and soils from your site, to confirm that the treatment is going to be effective for your site-specific chemistry. They can allow you to determine the type and dosing of amendments, and they provide data to support remediation or remedial design or a series of specific treatments. They're really great tools to use where your chemistry is complex or where multiple treatment steps might be needed. They're an effective and timely tool to provide degradation and transformation of contaminants or a suite of contaminants at your site, so give you some information on that. But they are often conducted under ideal mixing conditions, which can increase or decrease the resulting amendment requirement estimates relative to field conditions. So if you look at that photo on the bottom, you have microcosms there where you've got pretty much perfect connection between your amendment, groundwater, and soils. These are sitting on a shaker table in a lab at 25 degrees Celsius. So, it's going to give you really good information, but there's a scale issue there, and it's not showing you the complexity of what you're going to see at your site. The field heterogeneity and its influence on your amendment transport, reaction kinetics, or other characteristics can't be accurately duplicated in the laboratory. Now, the photo on the top is you're getting a little bit closer there where you've got column tests. So, you could be having groundwater flow along a column of materials from your site. And that's going to give you a better, maybe idea of some of the reaction kinetics and transport. But again, you don't have the complexity that you would have in the field. So, their bench tests are generally not accurate models of field conditions due to issues of scale. However, they are great initial screening level evaluations of potential outcomes, and effects of treatment and can be utilized to inform and initially optimize your remedial design and monitoring strategies. So one of the other things that you need to be considering when you're doing your design, and this is getting back to the question we had during the break, are secondary effects. So some of those secondary effects, they can occur over a wide range of time. Some of them could be transient shifts lasting hours or days. So that could be like an increase in water elevation or pressure due to your injection. Or long-term changes that can last for years, such as changes in redox or pH. And some of those secondary effects are things that you want, such as, let's say you want to change the redox because you're doing a bioremedy and you need to, get the right conditions for your degradation to occur. But some of them may be adverse or unwanted secondary effects. And those ones you need to understand and potentially mitigate. For example, sodium persulfate can be affect the natural or anthropogenic chromium present in soil or your aquifer matrix, which can then be oxidized to hexavalent chrome. So you need, if that is something that might be happening at your site, then you need to be either mitigating it or certainly monitoring for it so that you can understand what's happening. And one a great tool for doing evaluating these secondary effects are bench tests and pilot tests. So I'm going to pull up my first poll question, and it's a two-parter. So have you used bench testing in your design for an in-situ remedy? Okay, maybe we can take a look at the results we have.
So, Suzanne, this is both polls at the same time.
Is it?
Just give me, yep,
Okay. All right. Well,
give me
then,
10 more seconds and then we'll close.
okay. And so, if you have used them, then did the results of your bench test change your approach? Sorry, I didn't realize that both of them were going to pop up at once. So it looks like not quite half, I guess, of you have not used bench testing. But for those of you that have, some of the results of that has either, I guess, enforced your design, or for some of you, it's changed your approach for your next step of the remedy. So we'll close the poll then and move on to our next section. So we've got our bench test here. We've taken materials from our site. We're going to take soils and groundwaters from the site, and we're running some in-situ chemical oxidation testing and some bioremediation testing using emulsified vegetable oil as the donor. So the bench test results indicated that the ISCO is a faster remedy, but we are getting more secondary effects. And in the end, there's really a higher oxidant demand from the native materials than is ideal. The bio, although slower than ISCO, has few secondary effects, works out to be cheaper longer term. And so that was what was chosen as the option for going forward. So the next step then could be going to the field for a pilot test. So pilot tests tend to be small scale tests that are done at your site in situ. They're giving you a sense of the impacts of the heterogeneities on the performance of the remedial technology because they're applied at your site. They're going to allow you to evaluate the remedy timeframe under real world conditions, combining the effects of dilution, advective flow, diffusion, adverse chemical interactions. So it's giving you some real data of how it's going to work at your site. It's going to allow you to determine amendment distribution, radius of influence, the injection rates and pressures that you get or can sustain at your site, what kind of volumes you can inject. It's going to allow you to evaluate some of those secondary effects, metals mobilization, acid production. And another thing that pilot tests are good at are identifying locations to implement your performance monitoring longer time. So when you're going to you build your performance network, monitoring network, some of the data you're going to get out of your pilot test is going to give you a good sense of where those wells should be. So they're great to test the assumptions and incorporate that into the full-scale remedy design. So another key thing, obviously, when it comes to injecting any kind of amendment is the geology that you're injecting into, and the heterogeneity of the geology is definitely going to affect your amendment distribution. So in this depiction, the earth tone colors are the various geological layers, and the darker the brown are the lower the permeability. The warmer colors represent the areas of contamination, with the highest concentrations identified by orange. And then the purple color represents the amendment that's being injected into the subsurface at each one of those arrows. And as you can see in the less heterogeneous case, on the left there, we're getting a relatively good distribution around each one of those injection points. Whereas on this case on the right, you're getting a lot more variability in lateral influence versus depth because it's a much more layered subsurface. So you just need to be taking into consideration what your geology is like when it comes to designing your remedy. So tied to that, as you're trying to evaluate your distribution, the amendments are through that distribution through the porous aquifer media are controlled by the nature of the amendment itself, as well as that permeability of the formation. So the nature of the amendments, you could have soluble amendments such as lactate, semi-soluble such as emulsified vegetable oil, like we're using in our pilot test here, or insoluble such as zero-valent iron or activated carbon. And then for the permeability of your formation, the high permeability zones are the ones that are often going to receive the most fluid. So you're going to get the larger or broadest radial delivery. But if you have mass in those low permeability zones, then you do need to make sure that you understand how, what that's going to do, because it can provide a long-term source through back diffusion. And so you do need to make sure you're also understanding how you're going to get to treat in treatment into that lower K zone. Another key thing to be considering for your delivery strategy is what pressure you're going to be injecting under. So high pressure emplacement technologies using hydraulic or pneumatic methods are required to deform the aquifer matrix and propagate seams or fractures within the aquifer matrix. And you're going to have to use something like that if you're injecting a granular amendment, something like zero-valent iron or that carbon, where often those particles are larger than the pore throats that are available. So the only way to really distribute them is to deform that matrix. Soluble amendments like organic carbon substrates or chemical oxidants can be delivered at a wide range of pressures, and it will depend on, again, your specific design for whether you're using just gravity flow, low pressure, or some of those high pressure fracturing methods to distribute those. So we have this table in our design document, which looks at the various delivery techniques. So across the top of this table are the various delivery techniques, and each one of them has a link built into that table that you click on that will take you to a fact sheet that describes that delivery technique. How it can be used, what kind of equipment's necessary, some of the health and safety considerations. Along the left-hand column are specific characteristics that you might have at your site. And so, you've got a site with lots of cobbles, or you've got a competent or fractured bedrock. That kind of information is in that table, and then find the hydrogeologic characteristics that best match your site, and then you can evaluate whether various delivery techniques are widely used for that type of characteristic, can be used in site-specific situations, or are not applicable. And again, some of that information is provided in more detail in the fact sheets. So we finished our bench tests, and we're now ready at this case study to go into our pilot test. So we're injecting the emulsified vegetable oil at this site. And we went out and instrumented the site with some performance monitoring wells, and we're doing some direct injection of EVO in at the site. And what this pilot test is telling us is that we're getting a good radius of influence at low injection pressures with really good distribution of our amendment in our sand and silt layers. But when we're trying to do those injections in that clay layer, we're getting very high pressures, not getting very good distribution. There's evidence of short circuiting up into that sand layer. And so, we're not really getting much luck in our clay. So this pilot test would indicate that we have the right remedy design for our sands and silts, but we need to figure out something else possibly for that clay layer. So I'm going to pull up another dual poll. Have you used a pilot test in your design for an in situ remedy? And again, similar to the last time, if you have used a pilot test in your design, did it change? Did the results of that pilot test change your design? All right, take a look at our results. So it looks like a lot of people have used pilot tests, although some people maybe they had good luck with their pilot test, that didn't need to change their the results of their design and help confirm what they had. So again, you're out there collecting a lot of information in your pilot test, and all of that information should be feeding back into your full-scale design. Important to keep using and interpreting and adding that all the information you collect at each step of your process into your design and into your conceptual site model, which should be a living document. You're out there installing monitoring wells, log those wells. Does that geology match your conceptual site model for the site? Same thing with your direct injection. All of the the data that you're collecting can keep feeding into your understanding of the site. So we're ready to go full scale at this site. So we have injected our EVO throughout our sand and silt layer in our source area, and we've got some monitoring happening down gradient. But what are we going to do with this clay layer? So we are going all the way back to a bench test here. We're thinking maybe we should try something that's going to work in that clay. So we're thinking of switching to an electrokinetic approach or EK bio. So electrokinetic remediation uses low-level DC power to distribute your amendments in low permeability matrix. So you can use this direct current power to distribute electron donors like lactate or acceptors like oxygen or nitrate and/or even microcosms to help promote bio. And there's a fact sheet on that in the guidance document to provide some additional information. So we've taken some clay back from our site to the lab, and we're going to set up a little bench test where we've got an anode and a cathode along our on either end of our little clay column there. And EVO is not a good option for EK bio. So we're switching our electron donor to that in that clay there to lactate and doing some tests to see whether we can distribute that lactate using that direct current through the clay. We ran our bench test and we're seeing some really good distribution across the clay using EK. So we have a successful bench test and we're going to step that out now to the field. And do another pilot test. And we're going to do a really small scale pilot test again, just a two well test, an anode well and a cathode well. And we're going to apply our direct current to see if we can get good distribution of our lactate throughout our target treatment zone. And again, you're doing these pilot tests to confirm your design parameters and make sure that it's applicable as a remedy at your site. And again, we had a successful pilot test. So we go back out to our site where the bio is ongoing in the sand and silt, although it's not shown on this drawing. But then we instrument that site with a series of cathode and anode wells and apply our direct current to distribute the lactate underneath, throughout that clay layer. And as I said before, there is a fact sheet on EK in our guidance document. One of the nice things about EK is that you can switch which wells are cathodes and anodes and just run the power in different directions to help really maximize or evenly distribute your donor throughout your treatment zone. So, up to date, we've been looking sort of at the amendment delivery in cross section throughout, in our case study. But when you look at it in plan view, there are different ways of optimizing your delivery by refining the number and the spacing of injection points. And there's different ways of doing that. So, the grid pattern is probably the most broadly applicable, where you have evenly spaced delivery of injection points. And really, there are very few site constraints that would challenge this method. Depending on what your, amendment is and what your source zone is, one thing to consider would be maybe to inject on the outside of that grid pattern. And then go in towards the center to minimize the or limit some amount of plume spreading during your injection. The next one over there is an injection and drift approach, where you're leveraging the distribution of your amendments with the natural groundwater flow. So this would be applicable in situations either where your amendment is soluble in the groundwater, where the groundwater velocities are relatively high, or your amendment is relatively persistent, so that you can take advantage of the groundwater moving your amendment down gradient. So you can use less points to get a similar sort of distribution. Recirculation is another approach where you're simultaneously injecting your amendment in one well and extracting groundwater from another well. It can increase the lateral extent of amendment influence and reduce the risk of daylighting. So, for instance, at the beginning there, when I talked about maybe having a concern where your groundwater might discharge the surface water, this could be an approach that you could use either for the whole site or a portion of it, where you want to try to make sure you're protecting that surface water body by having the extraction wells to minimize daylighting. And then the last approach is a barrier approach, and it's a barrier to contamination, not to groundwater. So you basically just have a linear transect where your groundwater is able to flow through your treatment zone. So the things that affect another thing to consider, I guess, is the behavior and the persistence of your amendment is, are you dealing with something where you have low groundwater velocity or high groundwater velocity? And these are for soluble donors usually. And then, do you have a donor that's going to be highly persistent, something maybe like an emulsified vegetable oil versus something that's low persistent that'll get consumed quickly, like, say, lactate. And these are going to affect the distribution and behavior in the subsurface, and need to be, again, considered when you're looking at your distribution. The processes affecting your amendment distribution are the advection from a pressurized delivery, the advection due to natural groundwater flow, and then diffusion as a result of concentration gradients. And then the persistence is something going to be consuming your donor over time. So, this is the end of my section. Just driving home again that remedial design is iterative. You need to constantly evaluate the data you have, refine the design following the selection of amendment, and delivery strategies can involve bench testing, pilot testing. And the key is that the results of each of those tests need to feed back into the refinement of the next test that you're going to do, or the next version of your design. If you use an iterative approach and constantly evaluate the new data that you have, you're going to end up with a stronger design and a more successful remediation effort. So with that, I'm going to pass it to Dave to talk about implementation, monitoring, and interpretation.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Suzanne. Yeah, let's jump into sort of the next part, which is the implementation and the monitoring of the progress and performance of the technology that we're implementing. And more importantly, the interpretation of those data and the adaptive optimization that we would want to do based on those results. So I'm really going to be talking about section four, chapter four within the document. And on. There it is. All right. So the focus really of the chapter is the monitoring plus the decisions that you make based on that monitoring. And of course, the monitoring includes a baseline monitoring event before the full-scale implementation, just to establish, kind of an initial condition that we're going to compare our performance to a little bit later. There's also the potential for compliance monitoring that may be required, just to make sure that we're still protective and things aren't happening. Matter of fact, we may even have some sentinel wells located outside of our plume that's watching for any unexpected impacts to sensitive receptors like a production well or some type of water body, a stream or a lake or something like that. So we're going to be installing some monitoring points in addition to the, perhaps injection points or injection wells that are going to go in there. Those monitoring points are going to be, within our target treatment zone, maybe some downgrade in or outside of the target treatment zone, just to look at any of the impacts that occur because of the injections that we're doing. So we have those monitoring events that I just talked about, but really we're going to focus on the process monitoring. What data we're going to collect to really evaluate whether or not, our remedy is working as expected. The frequency and the things that we look for, the data we collect, really are very specific to the site conditions and to the technologies that we're applying. But we've got some good news on that front with some guidance within the document that I'll get to in just a moment. I do want to emphasize that even though we're often very focused on the contaminants of concern and other parameters, perhaps that have secondary cleanup goals, we can't forget the simple and cheap field parameters that we often collect. Those data, because they're cheap and quick, can often be very helpful, useful, and effective, big bang for the buck, in our evaluation of the need for optimization. We'll go on. The next slide is really just a couple of examples of the tables that are in section four of our guidance document. I know these aren't very readable, but we'll get to maybe some specific example of the content here in just a second. But the table on the left there is actually the table that has the analytical parameters that we might want to look for, some interpretation guidelines for looking at the results of those parameters, and then some recommendations that may come from that interpretation. And we'll focus just on some examples here. And the table on the right is actually for in situ chemical oxidation. So we've got anaerobic bioremediation on the left, ISCO on the right. So a couple of things that both tables have in common is the collection of data about any byproducts from the processes themselves. So for bioremediation, we may be looking at dissolved gases or the reduction in electron acceptors like sulfate. For ISCO, we may be looking for byproducts that may be formed as part of the chemical reactions. Just to kind of highlight those, with bioremediation, let's say we're looking at the reductive dechlorination for a common solvent like trichloroethylene. We're going to want to get at least into the sulfate reduction sort of range of reduction potential or even methanogenesis. So if our data show us that we're not getting a reduction in sulfate concentrations and an increase in sulfide, and we're not getting, say, the production of methane, maybe we're not in the right range here yet. And the simple to collect oxidation reduction potential. If it's not below a minus 120 millivolts, yeah, we're probably not in the right range either. Of course, ORP is a pretty easy parameter to collect. So that's a very easy and helpful one to collect. As far as ISCO goes, an example of the recommendations and conclusions that the table provides here is that the end products from the chemical reactions are probably going to dissipate fairly quickly. So that's a little bit reassuring. Another highlight on the bioremediation table there is let's say that we want to verify that we're in methanogenesis. We can collect parameters like dissolved oxygen and ORP again. If we're getting oxidation reduction potentials less than 200, minus 200 millivolts, we're probably getting into the methanogenic conditions, and the site's really cooking along and probably going to be able to make a good run and complete reductive dechlorination of our target analytes. Anyway, there are five different tables that are very useful in section four for laying out a monitoring program at our in situ injection technology sites like this. Certainly, when you undertake an in situ remediation and start implementing it, there's a number of questions that you're going to really want to consider and confront. The most obvious one is that when should you optimize? When would you want to consider an alternate technology if the one that you tried isn't working? Or when would you want to transition to something like M&A? That's an important question. There are other, maybe more detailed questions that are kind of listed there. What data am I collecting that's going to be helpful? Am I getting it all that I need in order to understand whether or not the remedy is underperforming or not? And then, can it be optimized? And if it can be optimized, which of the design criteria that we've heard about already really need to be focused on and addressed? Okay, so these are the kind of questions that would come up. And rather than going through kind of a dry presentation of just this sort of theoretical, situation, let's apply this to an actual case study. So we're going to give you a little bit of background about this case study site, and I really want to shout out to my ITRC team colleague, Elizabeth Ryan, for putting these slides together on this very good case study that really illustrates the monitoring and interpretation and decision making that we're really advocating in section four here. So a little bit of background. This is a site in the southeastern U.S. Total area about 380 acres. The plume is a small part of that, 12 acres, but unfortunately has some offsite impacts. It's a site in the Piedmont region, and Piedmont geology pretty typically heterogeneous with a saprolite of varying thickness, underlain by partially weathered bedrock, and then just bedrock below that, in this case, a granitic schist. The contaminants at the site were chlorinated organics, including carbon tet and TCE and their respective daughter products. The site owner had been dealing with the problem with a pump and treat system for over a decade, and it hadn't really been doing a lot. Matter of fact, it may have made things worse by actually dragging the plume a little bit towards the site boundary where the extraction wells were. And they recognized that, things could be done better, and there was a goal of transferring the property for redevelopment. And so they wanted to look at something that would be a little bit faster. So the idea here and kind of the initial optimization was to give a shot at anaerobic bioremediation. And so there were a number of other optimization steps that we'll talk about, but most of it was after implementation of the bioremediation, how to optimize that implementation using the monitoring that was being done. And one of the key things, and I'll reiterate this later, is that the monitoring data were collected on a monthly basis, and so that they could make quick turn type decisions, not wait till you got a compiled report at the end of a year or something like that. And again, the redevelopment was really driving that kind of time frame. So, as we'll talk about, they incorporated some changes to the bioremediation injection approach, and then actually implemented hydraulic fracturing. We'll talk about that. The contamination was largely located within the saprolite. Some had permeated into the bedrock due to a natural downward gradient. The idea here was to target the saprolite with the In-Situ Bio, with the expectation that the downward gradient would carry the appropriate conditions and amendment residuals down into the bedrock to deal with the relatively low concentrations that were there. However, they did have a contingency plan to deal with contamination within the bedrock if these kind of expectations of a natural transport of degradation didn't happen to materialize. So let's talk in a little bit more detail about some of the optimization steps that they did. So the initial remedy design was a grid pattern. The groundwater velocities at the site were relatively low. It wasn't a huge site, and the permeability was such that a grid approach was the most appropriate. And so they had 134 injection wells installed within 4.1 acres on a 25-foot center pattern. Okay, and again, they were only targeting the saprolite. One of the good things that they did is that they took advantage of the installation of these 134 points to really characterize the site further. And so there's a cross section shown on the figure here, which indicates that there was varying thickness of saprolite. There was actually a bedrock trough that was present at the site with the actual contaminant concentrated within the thickest part of the saprolite, with lower concentrations on the edges where the saprolite was a little bit thinner. Okay, again, a downward groundwater gradient from the saprolite into the bedrock was going to help deliver something down there. So they were just targeting the saprolite. They had a very nice injection system that was highly automated, with some type of programmable logic controller, so that they could change their dosage, the concentration of the carbon source that they were amending. And they could change the schedule on which the amendment was delivered or injected, and also to control the volumes that were delivered to different parts of the system. Okay, it'd be easier to explain that on the next slide. This is a plan view that shows the target treatment area, and you have the automated injection system. That above ground equipment was laid out to the upper left there, with a header pipe that delivered amendment to a number of laterals that you see there. That header pipe, which is the dark line, actually runs through like this over about 350 feet, fed these different laterals and tended to track along with the thickest part of the saprolite. So they were, where you had more target volume, they were closer to the header lines, which was a good idea. Concentrations were highest on the left side, over here. That was the source area. Lower concentrations, and you can kind of see the gradation in the color there. Lower concentrations to the right there, in a down gradient direction there. All right, so they started the system up. The implementation began in that source area, sort of to the upper left in that target treatment zone. They got textbook response. MCLs were actually met within 6 months within their performance monitoring well. The graph that's shown on this slide here shows the decline in one of the contaminants, carbon tet, over time, and the incremental or the sequential production, I should say, of the daughter products, chloroform and methylene chloride, both of which also diminish by the end of 6 months. So very successful there. So everybody was pleased with that. However, contrary to what you might expect, even though the source area cleaned up very rapidly, the downgrading areas stayed contaminated based on available information from monitoring that was done in those areas. They weren't getting a lot of organic carbon from the amendment delivered. The ORP values were not particularly negative. Matter of fact, some areas were still aerobic. So that was, an indication things weren't working as expected, and there was probably some room for optimization. But normally you would expect, that the lower concentration downgradient distal part of your treatment area would clean up first, not the high concentration source area. So this was, really kind of unexpected. So just to kind of summarize what the data evaluation was after that 6 month initial period, they saw an increase in daughter products up in the source area, but not in the downgradient area. They did notice that the pH dropped slightly after 12 months, certainly relative to baseline. There was some concern that a further drop in pH would take it out of the range of comfort for the bacteria. And so they were a little bit concerned about that. Again, the conditions weren't created appropriate for biodegradation across the plume. And that was quite the puzzle yet. So this is kind of a nice color-coded cartoon showing the response here. We had very reducing conditions shown by the orange and reds on the left there, and at best nitrate reducing to aerobic on the right in the downgradient part of the site there. Again, this is an example of those field parameters being very useful to understand what's going on. So, based on what you've heard and the problems that we've had, trying to get that distal in, what do you think the problem is? Do you think it's of those three design criteria, delivery dose, an amendment, or some combination of them, maybe all of them? What do you think was the problem? Why did we have this slow to react or not reacting part of the plume? So go ahead and take time and fill in this poll question here, thinking about, what, given the extent and that, what might have been the problem? We had one area reacted great, one area that did not react so well. So, why the difference? What do you think? Is it dose, delivery, or amendment, or all of the above? Okay. Devin, have we let it go long enough to see the results here? Ah, very good. The majority of folks appear to have picked all of the above. And that indeed is what the project team concluded as well. So they went back and you can go ahead and close that now. So very good. Let's go ahead and see what they did to address this. Okay. So just, I've already kind of gone through the situation here. They weren't getting the organic carbon from the amendment out there. So that really tells you that there was a dose delivery kind of thing. They were worried about the pH issues. They just weren't getting a good radius of influence of amendment in those downgradient injection well. So they revisited the remediation design characterization. They revisited the design wheel following that kind of loop back there. And they thought about ways to increase the radius of influence in the downgradient wells. What they thought was that that the lines closer to the automated injection system, closer to the above ground equipment, the amendment solution, which was a molasses amendment, by the way, the pressures in that header line were higher. And actually quite positive, closer to the injection system. Farther down gradient, it became really just a gravity feed system. So they think they got much better delivery and volumes released in those nearer laterals there in the source area, and they weren't getting much out. So in order to address that, what they did was to increase the volume of injection. They also thought that operating continuously, and what they had been doing previously was the system would just go down the line, injecting into each set of laterals until they got to the end, and they would start back at the beginning and just go back through that. So they decided to cut back on the frequency of injection, but increase the volume, and then add a clean water flush to force the amendment out of the header pipe and the lateral pipes into the wells in order to make sure that the amendment got delivered out there. A couple other things that they did, they again were worried about the pH drop. And rather than adding another amendment with all the controls and storage and everything that would be necessary, something like a sodium bicarbonate or a sodium hydroxide, they just decided to change the solution strength. They went from a 10% molasses to a 5% molasses. The lower carbon loading like that generated less fatty acids that then made it less likely you were going to get a substantial pH drop, yet still provided the carbon necessary for the conducive conditions. They also had an interesting problem with fermentation on warm days within the holding tank of the solution, where it actually would bubble up and over at the top of the tank. And so they added a mixer to that to stir the holding tank to keep that fermentation down a bit. So that was just some examples of the adaptive optimization for that. And sure enough, after 12 months after that first change, after this change to inject more in that downgrading area, they cleaned up a lot more of that distal part of the plume. But they still had one recalcitrant area there in the southeast part, that lower right part of the plume, where concentrations kind of persisted. And so it was time for another optimization. So, given the success that we had, or that they had, with the modification with that first optimization to bio, they got a lot more of that distal area, but there was something going on in this recalcitrant area. So, do you think it was a delivery problem, a dose problem, an amendment problem? Go ahead and fill out that poll question. Maybe it's all of the above. But we know that the amendment works from the other areas. We know that the dose worked for the other part of the distal plume, right? So what's left? So what do you think? Give some thought to that. If I haven't given enough hints already. Okay. So we'll wait just a moment more here. Let's take a look at the results and see what people think about this. Okay. Yeah, more people thought it was a delivery question. Yeah. The other answers, perfectly fine too, but I would tend to agree it's a delivery issue. So let's go ahead and see what they did in response to this. So thanks for closing that, Devin. And so they decided to revisit their characterization and the design wheel again in accordance with our guidance document. They looked at the boring logs in those areas. Again, they took good logs of all those injection wells, and they realized that this recalcitrant area had a more predominant silt and clay lens geology there. And they suspected that they had contaminant mass that was not being reached by the amendment that was residing in those silt and clay layers. So how do we deliver something into those clay and silt layers? That became the question. And what they thought is that maybe hydraulic fracturing, creating fractures, filling that fracture with sand that make a permeable pathway into these low permeability layers to get better access to the contaminant mass by the amendment and to promote the biodegradation. So, still a question on whether or not it would work. So they decided to do a pilot study. Again, if you've got more permeable zones, a lot of the amendment will bypass thicker silt and clay layers. And so that's what they were trying to target. So the fracturing was to fracture the silt and clay layers, shorten diffusion path lengths for the amendments and to promote the degradation within them. Okay. They were going to want to, do a number of these fractures to really address these silt and clay layers. So they installed, a pilot test. They installed a number of piezometers at different depths adjacent to where they were going to do the injection, the borehole where they were going to do the injection. So they went ahead and created a fracture at 40 feet below the ground surface there and injected water into the fracture. And that went into the fracture, and then they looked for the signature of that injected water in the piezometers that were installed at different depths to get a sense for what kind of vertical interval around that fracture they would actually get some kind of effect. And again, this fracture is opened with hydraulic pressure, and sand in a carrier was injected as a proppant, and then that leaves behind this nice permeable sort of pancake-like surface that will accept the amendment and deliver it into those silt and clay layers. And what they found by looking at the responses that the influence was observed 3 to 4 feet on either side of that fracture. So very instructive pilot test. Okay, so that kind of gives you an idea, that little animation of where that effect went. So they went ahead based on the pilot, implemented that as full scale, fracturing at about 7 foot intervals within that saprolite. They stayed above the transition zone and the bedrock itself. They didn't want to have anything short circuit down there. They had up to five fractures depending on the thickness of the saprolite. They installed piezometers at different distances away from the borehole where the fractures were created, and installed an injection well that communicated with each of those fractures. And the piezometers were different distances to get a sense for how far out the effects would go, because they had the vertical impact characterized, but lateral was still kind of a question. So that's the injection well. Again, that was connected to each of the fractures. So the ultimately what you would look at here was, again, injection well above the transition zone of bedrock in the saprolite with appropriate monitoring at different distances here. The little inset map on the upper left there kind of shows the layout of the piezometers around that. This again was a full pilot test. Again, they implemented it within that recalcitrant area, operated it with the injection. Over 9 months, they were able to complete the hydraulic fracture pilot study and install the injection wells with the fractures. It turned out to be quite successful. At the same time they were doing that in the recalcitrant area, they were monitoring for rebound in those other areas that had attained MCLs. And what they found was that there was just nominal rebound in areas where previously they had met the MCL, but that the concentrations diminished back over time. So it showed that even though there was some back diffusion, the MNA was going to be effective at reducing those concentrations, and it didn't require any further active treatment. Again, one of those questions that transitioned to a passive kind of approach like MNA. Okay. So just to recap, the hydraulic fracturing generated a very generous 45-foot radius of influence for each fracture set. They continued to use the automated injection system, but just hooked up their new injection wells to that, injected once a month. As I said, they had two injection events, and they did meet their goals to where they could transition to M&A. And their transition criteria to M&A was to get concentrations with down below 5 times the MCL for the contaminants of concern or the daughter products. And they were able to do that. So ultimately, what they saw in terms of the redox conditions were very methanogenic conditions in that recalcitrant area. The source area farther up gradient and to the upper left there was returning back to aerobic conditions and recovering already. So that was expected, but good to see. So again, just to reiterate, they did transition to M&A. This is a common question about when do you stop? Going to M&A sounds like it's going to save you a ton of money compared to active treatment. But if that M&A period goes on for a very long time, you have the monitoring costs, the reporting costs, maybe even 5-year review costs that are going to add up over time. And so you have to look at the cost versus benefit of continued active treatment to take it a little bit lower, the concentrations lower to shorten the time frame. So it really is kind of this looking at a trade-off curve to see where's the best place to stop active treatment. And of course, the regulatory environment's going to make a difference of when you can do that, as would the final site use. Residential use might be different than commercial or industrial use down the road. At this site, again, they were transitioning at when concentrations got below 5 times the MCL. So ultimately, even though the original redevelopment plan before they put it on the market was to have it redeveloped as industrial, the only interest was from a developer who wanted to put apartments on the build on the site. So the site owner put in deed restrictions, I believe, in order to require vapor barriers as part of the foundations for these residences, so that you wouldn't have any potential vapor intrusion from rebound or whatever. Because the owner was somewhat risk averse, didn't want to have something come back to them a little bit later. The residential development was eventually allowed and occurred, and so it had kind of a happy ending. So, just to recap, they treated 4.1 acres of target treatment zone and achieved the MCLs, or at least close to it. Natural attenuation was going to be used to deal with the remaining part of the plume that was quite low in concentration to begin with. Bedrock was remediated. The future use of the property was achieved, which was very gratifying. So just some key concepts. And again, hopefully what you've seen here is this idea of taking the monitoring data and thinking about it and making decisions about how to improve and optimize based on what you've seen, and being somewhat maybe innovative in what you do to react to that. So at this site, there were 4 cycles of optimization to get to the M&A levels. Let's see. Monthly evaluation was critical because they had a tight schedule for redevelopment. And it is important to have contingency plans in case things don't quite work out. And I just want to put a plug in here for another ITRC guidance document on remediation risk management, which advocates looking at the way things might not work as expected and to have mitigation or contingency actions, planned for those risks that seem likelier to have a high impact. So take a look for that other document. Chapter 4 or Section 4 of the document addresses 5 remediation technologies, a couple of bioremediation technologies, ISCO, chemical reduction, surfactant, co-flushing. So take a look at that section. And there's a lot of good tables. I already mentioned some. There are links to fact sheets that address some of these issues shown on this. Very useful, very, very useful document. So with that, I would like to turn it back over to Chris to talk about regulatory and stakeholder considerations.
Well, thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. Appreciate the plug for more recent ITRC documents. We are always cranking stuff out at least a couple, 2 or 3 every year, and the training that goes along with it, like we're having right now. So, moving ahead. Okay. So basically, we as regulators need this document too, so that we don't fall into the old ways of linear thinking. And that's another benefit of presenting an optimization document via the web and ITRC, as I just said, to expose the states to this iterative, interactive way of thinking and design. As you see from this graphic, EPA recognized the need for an adaptive management style for their Superfund projects. This figure, which was modified from that memo, clearly shows an iterative process similar to the key graphic in this document. Even though remedial activities may occur in situ, i.e., underground or on private property, the activities are noticed by people living and working in the surrounding communities. They want to know the activity may affect their lives. Honest and upfront communication can go a long way to alleviate the fear of the unknown. It may also reveal potential consequences that were not previously thought of. So it's important to develop a media communication plan, identifying a single point of contact, and anticipate questions in advance, and develop a fact sheet and a list of FAQs to answer those questions. All right. We want you to use this document. Use it like your toolbox. Use the table in Appendix B for your table of contents to place you in the right portion of the document. Make sure your CSM is complete by referring to Table 2-2. Dive into the fact sheets, as Dave and Suzanne and especially Rich were mentioning. Use the hot links. As I stated in my introduction, use this document for making predictable and optimized outcomes for in-situ remedies using sound science and engineering, going back to the definition there of optimization. As soon as we end this webinar, go to the guidance document on the web and upload Appendix F checklist to begin using everything you've learned here for your site. Again, thank you for attending. It's now time for our last Q&A session. Devin?
All right, thank you, Chris. Let me just stop remote control here. So, as Chris mentioned, we will have our last Q&A portion of the training right now, and then we will end our webinar. Just as a quick reminder for everybody that the feedback form is the link is on the slide. This link is not active, but it is also located on the Clumin training page that brought you to the webinar here today. All right, I will look to our Q&A pod and start reading out some of those questions for our trainers. Five times cleanup level was mentioned when reverting to M&A. Are there certain low levels where injections are just not feasible compared and just starting with M&A?
Yeah, this is Dave Becker. Let me take a crack at that. Yeah, I probably should have made this point in the lecture when we were talking about that. But for something like bioremediation, as the concentrations get lower, it becomes increasingly difficult to sustain the bacteria that are actually the ones degrading those contaminants. And so you often see kind of a plateauing as you get to lower concentrations. And so it's not unusual to have some transition to M&A occur at those lower concentrations because it becomes increasingly difficult to sustain the bacterial populations. One thing that I'll note though, if you use reductive dechlorination, sometimes with the sulfate reduction and iron reduction that you get, you can be forming iron sulfides if those are naturally present in the formation materials. And those iron sulfides can be reactive minerals that will abiotically help destroy some of the contaminants as well. And so even after you may have diminished carbon source for bioremediation, reductive dechlorination, you might still have some abiotic processes that will work, as natural attenuation to polish it off, even if you stop above the MCL. That's the way I'd answer that one.
All right, thank you, Dave. All right, it looks like that's it for our questions. So just a few wrap-up points for our attendees. We would like to thank you for all the questions asked during our training. If you would like any follow-up on any questions or answers provided, feel free to get in touch with us at training@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to get in touch with our trainers directly, as their contact information is listed on the Clumin training page that brought you here today. A big thank you to our expert trainers for being here today and for their contribution to the ITRC document and training team. And a special thank you to our participants today. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us for these webinars. Remember, we do archive our classes, so if you're unable to join a live class, you're always welcome to access one of the archives located on the Clueen website. With that, I would like to just wish everybody a wonderful rest of their day and thank you for attending. Hopefully, we will see you in a future ITRC webinar.